The Greed of the Lone Wolf.
I am the Lone Wolf. I am under cover of day and night. I conduct surveillance, reconnaissance, and intelligence on my enemies. I do not join groups or organizations due to informants, agent provocateurs, and troublemakers. I avoid being on a list. Even if I'm on a list, I have a list of data on them also. I know where they live, where they go shopping, where their kids go to school, where their spouse works, what model their vehicle is, where their relatives live, where they go for recreation, who their friends are, their habits, and even their birthdays. I studied and researched people like the Unabomber, BTK Wichita, Kansas serial killer, Eric Rudolph, and others the same, and learned from their mistakes. I'm prepared for the coming war. I'm ready when the line is crossed. My Aryan race, liberties, and freedoms are infringed upon. For now, I never engage in terrorism or violent acts until the time comes. I don't start the trouble. My enemies do that and shall give me the excuse to fight back. I am prepared if I am detained and arrested or questioned by authorities who have no authority over me, but do my best to avoid being a person of interest. I keep records in my brain on my enemies and avoid having electronic data devices and computer with information on them in case they are confiscated if I do. They are secretly hidden away from my property, including how-to books, weapons, equipment needed for the coming war. I protect my information and my informants and sources the best I can who are working inside the government and non-government agencies who provide me with intelligence information to better myself and others when the coming battle begins. I create phony websites on a white supremacist gang and leaflets on this gang to neighborhoods, even some graffiti and plant evidence to make it look like there's a gang in the area scaring and confusing ignorant whites, race mixers, liberal media, non-whites, and law enforcement. They can't figure it out. It's called PSYOPs. I am the underground secret freedom fighter and independent. I'm in your neighborhood. I'm in your schools. I'm in your police departments, bars, coffee shops, malls, and so on. I am the Lone Wolf.
And this is the Insurgent Radio Network.
Hey, Brother Kenya, spare the time. I can't decide where we should draw the line. Our family dreams, they are stained. I can't accept this as our fate. I won't accept this as our fate. And as I wish upon the star tonight, will our people ever see the light? Is a new dawn just around the bend? Hey, brother, when's it gonna end? Children to look at us with disappointment and disgust. We want to teach them to carry on, to be strong long after we're gone, to bear the torch long after we're gone. And as I wish upon this star of night, will our people ever see the light? Is a new dawn just around the bend? Hey, brother, when's it gonna end? Mm-hmm. and bread to stand our ground. To not achieve, no, not back down. Not see these people just standing there. They've no worries, no, they've no cares. They don't worry cause they don't care. And as I wish upon this star tonight, will our people ever see the light? Is a new dawn just around the bend? Hey brother, when's it gonna end? As I wish upon this star tonight, will our people ever see the light? Is a new dawn just around the bend? Hey brother, when's it gonna end?
And here's General Tommy back here in the bunker. The Robert J. Matthews Order Brüder Schweigen Memorial Bunker. Don't forget it. I know a lot of people have forgotten all about it, and some of them don't even want to remember or think about it happening, but we memorialize it here. And if that doesn't make you happy, well, you can go back over to the right wing and whine with those guys. Because we ain't going to have it here. The insurgent is at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for our daily radio show, 6 shows a week, 1 hour a day. And we try to dig up some good information for you from different places around. And sometimes it's surprising where we get information from. And some right-wingers out there call me, he's a goddamn communist. I can tell he's a Bolshevik because he digs up stuff that pertains to working class people. And primarily the white working class. But sometimes our information coincides with problems of other people and other races too. So that's the way that goes. Well, I bet you don't even remember what this date signifies. 1836. Now rack your brain. Rack your brain real quick. What happened today in 1836? Well, this is the day the battle for the Alamo started. Yeah. Today. We're a few hundred people. What was it? A couple of hundred people. Most of them weren't even American citizens. That's right. Most of them were from different countries all over Europe. Sort of like a Waffen SS. Some were American citizens, but most of them were not. And willing to fight to the death. How many people do you know that are willing to fight to the death today? I haven't known many. Handful. Maybe two handfuls over the years. Of course, some people you don't know until the time comes whether they're willing to die for what they believe in. Or what's worse, to be incarcerated for 40 years or 50 years. In a gulag. Yeah, you know, I had some contact with some people who are a little bit over into that revisionist side. And I sort of moved away from it quite a long time ago because I think it's like beating a dead horse. In fact, might surprise you, but I have another theory about that. Now, you might say that Metzger's theories are, he's a whack job, in which a lot of the right wing say. But I was in high school in the 50s, graduated in 1956. I don't remember anything being said about millions of Jews being killed or cremated or anything like that. I don't remember any of that. I mean, I think I would remember if they had talked much about it. But how come here 10 years after the war ended, you didn't hardly hear anything about the Jews and the Holocaust? Then all of a sudden, I guess it started in the 60s. A few people started writing things about it. Mostly apologists for the national capitalism. It got out of hand. Yes, it did get out of hand. It wasn't what National Socialism was supposed to end up being. It was supposed to be broadening the reach of the white Aryan race, the Germanic people, and so forth and so on, and evolve into a United States of Europe, and including Russia and all that. But what happened? It seems like that went over the hill, where millions of people all over Europe died. And if the intent of national capitalism was to advance the white race, they sure didn't seem to do it in a very good way, by declaring war on people and so forth. And then, and equally guilty, the people in the other countries doing bad things to Germany and so forth. So anyhow, then in the early 70s, a magazine was revived, as far as I recall. It was called American Mercury. And it had some of that type of writings in it. And it was being promoted by Noontide Press, which was located in Los Angeles. As I recall, it was West L.A. I used to go up there all the time and buy books. A lady by the name of LaVon Furr run the bookstore. But she was hired by Willis Carto. It was his operation. And then gradually there got to be more of this talking about, 6 million didn't die and all that kind of stuff. And several more writers started writing about it. And all of a sudden we had the Institute for Historical Review. Sometimes I jokingly call it the Institute for Hysterical Review. I think it was a mistake, and I'll tell you why. Did you ever watch the film Manchurian Candidate? No, not the one with the nigger in it. I mean the original, and how clever the communists were to entrench a guy into the American Washington system, pretending to be a big right-winger. But actually working for the communists. There's a very important lesson to be seen, picked up in that film. Well, I think that's probably what happened. Some well-meaning people that wanted to say that the killing of the Jews was exaggerated. And so all of a sudden it becomes 6 million. They just picked it out of the air, 6 million. There was no real mathematical equation or anything else. They just picked it out of the air. And a lot of good people fell for the bait. And some of them weren't too Simon Pure about it, that they were trying to prove a fact or the evidence that 6 million people did not be killed. They were out more to clean up the image of National Socialism that went off the tracks into National Capitalism in Germany, and trying to clean up Hitler's act. Well, Hitler did some good things for Germany, but in the end he did very bad things. And attacking Russia, 20 million people died in that war. I mean, a million people on each side died at Stalingrad. Most of them were white. So things got a little out of hand there. But unfortunately, a lot of the youth got into this thing about, there was no Holocaust. Well, the word was invented by the Jews, of course. But thousands of Jews did die. But, like I've said, 55 million people died in World War II. Why would you cry for, even if it was 6 million Jews, why wouldn't you be crying for all the people who died in World War II? And if you don't want genocide, don't have war. Because all the Jews that cry about World War II's effect on Jewry, most of them, their ancestors and even them, were involved in the ripping off the German people in World War I. they supported World War One. In fact, they went to the White House and pleaded with Woodrow Wilson to get involved, and he did. And so millions of people died in that war too, but it led to the Second World War. So if people didn't like Hitler coming to power and doing bad things to the Jews or whatever you think, then the people who voluntarily drug us into World War One should be at least partially to blame, and a good share of them were Jews that were ripping off Germany like they always do before and after a war. Military-industrial complex. Every country's got one. So I have become very suspicious. Now, I've crossed swords quite a few times with some of these pseudo-intellectual revisionists, and a lot of them are good writers, and they tell a good story, and in many cases, it's at least partially true. But what happened after the Institute for Historical Review got started? All of a sudden, the Jews were challenged, and it gave them an opening. And so Jaime says, hey, let's behind the scenes sort of promote this thing, and 'cause we can react to it. If nobody's out there putting out stories about there was no Holocaust, it's a little difficult for us to react to it. But if we can get this right wing, and in many cases innocently, to think they're going to set the world straight with all this information, we can react to it. And all of a sudden, what did we see? Spielberg, multi-million dollar movies. The Holocaust and all these movies and Schindler's List come pouring out of Hollywood. They had not done that in the 50s, late 50s. They hadn't even done that in the early 60s. But all of a sudden, the Jews said, hey, here they're handing us a meal ticket here. Let's go for it. And I believe that the revisionist movement has been used to distract people and to give an excuse for museums for the Holocaust all over Europe, all over the United States, which I don't believe would have happened if they'd let it alone. The other thing is, it's just like the Cold War. I spent a hell of a lot of money and a hell of a lot of my time fighting communists where there were no communists. I was always looking for a communist under every bed. But while we were wrapped up in that Cold War, guess what happened? Our racial laws went down the tube. The blacks were financed by the Jews to come on with their civil wrongs movement. And Robert Welch, and I remember it well, who's saying anybody out there who belongs to the John Birch Society and who's into racism of any kind, you're con-simps, I believe you call it, com-simps, communist sympathizers. You're actually working for the communists. Pretty clever, huh? Well, I don't want to work for the communists. I've been fighting the communists for years. What are you saying, man? Well, if you're standing up for the race and protecting your schools and everything else from the incursion of blacks and so forth, and immigration into the country, well, you're a com simp. You're sympathizing with, you're a communist agent. Even though the Birch Society itself had a speakers bureau and ex-communists came around, Julia Brown and Leonard Patterson, I talked to them both personally back in the day. They're probably both dead by now, but anyhow, both were communist agents, black communist agents. And both told me on separate occasions their big program in the United States was to mix the races, that the Soviet Union apparatus saw that as the best way to destroy the United States. Not so much fighting communism, but employing race mixing. mongrelization, as Senator Bilbo talked about on the congressional floor back in the day when people had guts. So, anyhow, so you'll see me every once in a while cross swords with these people, because when you talk about race to most of these revisionists, they run screaming. We can't have race, can't talk race. It's just the Jews. If we take care of the Jews, everything will be fine. Well, Hitler got rid of a lot of Jews, but everything didn't turn out fine. Sad to say, whether you like it or not, the Jews are not going to go away. The best that you can do is criminalize the elite Jews and put them away. I mean, all the ones that get into banking and all that, these crooked bankers and Wall Street people, and people who produce books and education that mislead your people and all that kind of stuff. And quit worrying about every little Jew down the street that's running a bagel shop. So anyhow, if I had the money, I'd make a Manchurian Candidate-style movie about how we were betrayed on the racial issue and switched over to another set of tracks. That if we just take care of the Jews, everything will be okay. Well, what about these millions of black people around here? Oh, no. Don't worry about them. You take care of the Jews and that black problem will go away. Oh, do you think so? Do you think so? And so then they say, well, you hate all the black people. You want to kill all the black people. I've never said that. I'm a white racial separatist. I'm not a white supremacist, even though I hope that we are intellectually and scientifically superior. But that doesn't make any difference. If you have racial separation, I'm not picking on black people. They'd be over there and I'd be over here. When I was a kid, we lived in a racially separatist environment in which there were no blacks around. One black family in the whole town. And you'll find if you only have one black family in the whole town, they mind their business in P's and Q's, just like in the army. When we had one or two blacks in a unit, the unit went along quite well. But you get more than that in a unit, and it goes to hell in a handbag. Now, most ex-military guys, white guys, could tell you that, and even some blacks, because there are blacks out there that are obviously superior to other blacks, and they see what the rabble in their race can cause, just like the rabble in our race. But when I say rabble, I mean rabble at the top and the bottom. The worst rabble among the white race is at the top. So every once in a while you're going to hear somebody taking a swipe at old Terrible Tommy, which that goes with the program. But most of the time they're mad about something that they don't want to confront. They don't want to listen to the facts. Now, look, even David Irving, the champion of the revisionists, from what I understand, and I don't really follow this stuff much anymore like I once did, that David Irving has said, too, there was the Holocaust. Well, of course, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews died. And they had all the pit killings in the Russians. The Russians were killing them, the Germans were killing them, the Polish were killing them, and so forth. So, you know, if you want to get mean about it, just say, I don't care. That stops the conversation real quick. But if you want to put a little sugar on it, you say, yeah, you're right. Hundreds of thousands of Jews died, and most of them were probably just working-class Jews that shouldn't have been killed. Okay, it was wrong. And the biggest thing that was wrong is you let all the top Jews get away. They don't talk about that much. The train loads of the super-rich Germans that were private trains that were going out of Germany with all their goods and Jew women wearing their furs and loading up the baggage cars with their artwork and all that kind of stuff. You see, doesn't that smell to you that most of the Jews that got screwed in the concentration camps were working class Jews, or at most middle class, who really had not that much control at all on the system? But the rich Jews, the big shots, they got out. And think about that. And think about what has revisionism done for us. Now, when I knew all these people that were in the Institute for Historical Review, and David McCollin was a friend of mine off and on. We used to argue like hell. David McCollin was a real honest, straight shooting, factual kind of guy. And he wrote the pamphlet, little booklet, Exiles from History, which is a very, very good booklet. But he couldn't get along with the King Cardo, and Cardo fired him, or he left, and like that. And then Tom Marcellus came along and took over. I'm in and out of this place, you know, every couple of weeks, so I know sort of what's going on. In fact, I had one of my Klan unit leaders was working there, a lady, and she'd fill me in on everything that was going on. And Tom Marcellus, of course, was a big promoter of Scientology. And he brought Scientology into the Institute for Historical Review. And he was even getting people involved in Scientology and shaking them down. This one lady I'm talking about, he got her to put a few thousand dollars into the operation, which simply went into the coffers of Scientology. And I warned her about it, and she tried to get her money back, and she finally did get her money back. If you want to know whether I knew these people, well, David McCollum is, I did a television show, My Race and Reason, with him. And Tom Marcellus, I've got the DVDs and 3/4-inch tapes of all those shows. So I knew all these guys, and I knew their good points and their bad points. But isn't it strange that all of a sudden we have what they call neo-Nazis turning up over there in Ukraine? I saw their pictures, too. Some of the head guys looked about like some of the motorcycle gang guys over here. One guy's waving a pistol around. He must have weighed about 270 pounds. And he just got out of jail. Reminds me of the Bolsheviks. You know, that's the kind of people they used, too. Well, these people are not National Socialists. But it's interesting that they're not exposing the fact that some of these people are coming from the BNP in England, and maybe the English Defense League, and some of these right-wing outfits that the leaders should know better. They should know that that the people running this thing to join Ukraine to the EU and so forth, the big shots are Jews. You know, I don't have his name here, the one big steel magnet who robbed the Russian people after the Soviet system collapsed, and he grabbed a hold of the big steel mills, and now he's over there supporting this. Let's go with the EU. And then you got these phony National Socialists. They're not National Socialists. They don't know anything about National Socialism, I'll bet. In fact, I meet very few people in this country that really know anything about National Socialism. But they call themselves what the Jews call themselves, Nazi. I'm a Nazi. Or they run out and get a swastika tattooed on their arm and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, I would venture to say that... Well, I've already said it. If revisionism hadn't become so supported by the right wing, and the right wing would have kept to their problems with the race issue, things would be a lot better today. But the Jews are very clever, And I study them very carefully. I read all their stuff. I mean, I read their newspapers, their magazines, and I see how clever they are and how our side keeps falling into the trap. Just keeps falling into the trap. So all those pseudo-intellectual revisionist writers and leaders out there that want to say Tommy's a bad guy, well, that's all right. We'll see what happens when it comes out in the wash later on. We'll see. Was Tommy right or was he wrong? I think you're going to find that I was right. But watch that film, Manchurian Candidate, to get an idea of the double cross and the cleverness of your enemies. Because the basis of operating of the communists and their cell structure was good, but it was Jewish. Well, once in a while they'd kill a Jew and make an example out of him, but communism was very Jewish. They loved it. So, anyhow, let's get on to something else here. And if you've got any further questions about this particular subject, well, ask me. If I know the answer, I'll tell you. And believe me, Terrible Tommy never pulls punches. I give straight answers for straight questions. Now, if you're a capitalist and got all the money in the world to spend, one of those billionaires like Warren Buffett, this should be for you. The Chinese have got a new deal going. It's the Chinese company will 3D print a life-size copy of you for $28,000. The Chinese company Pinla 3D has opened a new mall shop in Nanjing, China, that offers several sizes in which one may 3D print a copy of oneself. The prices range from $160 for a 5-inch duplicate all the way up to roughly $28,550 for a full-on life-size clone. The in-store customer scanning process requires just a few minutes, but the 3D printing itself takes 2 to 3 weeks. On the Pinla 3D website, you can take a look at the many different examples of statues the company has printed. There you go. Pinla, P-I-N-L-A, 3D. And get them while they're hot, baby. Sounds to me like maybe a Chinese Jew came up with that stuff. Well, I see an American anchor lady that I've seen a few times. They worked on state-owned television station Russia Today, quit on the air on Wednesday. Liz Wahl, W-A-H-L, in the network's D.C. bureau, color her Jewish, announced that she could no longer be part of a network that whitewashes the actions of Putin. I'm proud to be an American and believe in dissemination of the truth. And that's why, after this newscast, I'm resigning. Quote, "It actually makes me feel sick that I worked here," unquote, Wahl told the Daily Beast exclusively. Well, she needs to go over and work for Fox News, where they have all the truth. All the truth that fits the Republican right-wing party. She had been planning this move for some time. Quote, "When I came on board from the beginning, I knew what I was getting into. But I think I was more cautious and tried to stay as objective as I could," unquote, she said, explaining that she was repeatedly censured by her superiors. In other words, like any boss, tell you what to do. "The Kremlin influence over the RT is subtle," Wahl said. "But management manipulates its employees, punishing those who stray from the narrative." Quote, "In order to succeed there, you don't question," Wahl explained. Well, that's the way it is on any television network. People are fired all the time. Yeah, try to say something on your own on any network and see what happens to you. RT has had some doozies recently, like, quote, "Self-defense force ranks swell in anticipation of Crimea showdown with the radicals," and "Tea sandwiches, music, photos with self-defense forces mark peaceful Sunday in Semperpol." Well, anyhow, we'll leave that go. It's a longer article. It's going to be all over the web, because obviously you do get a little bit more truth, I believe, on RT. Not that I believe that everything is true on RT, but for this Jewess to say that RT is unfair, and that's like the pot calling the pan black. The American networks lie so badly that it makes RT look very good. I usually watch two programs on there. Sometimes I turn on the live news, and it's Crosstalk. Crosstalk, I think, is an excellent program. And Mike Kaiser is, I think, very good, too. So those are the two I like to watch. Well, here's a little article that's interesting. Before we have a display of butt-faced, pig-headed arrogance, insolence, and intrusion from Mr. John Ketchup Manufacturer Kerry, that's how he got his money, married rich woman, in Kiev, let us see the real issues behind the scenes. Let us cut the hype and the hysteria, and let us start from a clear standpoint that the United States of America has not one iota of moral credibility to lecture anyone on anything. Well, that's true. Before we have another display of butt-faced ignorance, pig-headed arrogance, and unadulterated jingoistic crap, and chauvinistic bilge from Mr. Kerry and his NATO sidekicks, let us make one thing crystal clear. Who invaded Iraq against every fiber of international law? Who strafed civilian structures with military hardware? Who handed out billionaire rebuilding contracts without tender? Who masterminded the theft of countless artifacts from Baghdad's museums? Who held prisoners illegally? Who had them tortured, humiliated, beaten, urinated on, their food urinated in? Who had them forced to eat pork, deprived of sleep, and murdered in cold blood? Who's responsible for the maiming and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children? Who strafed Vietnamese kids with napalm? Who committed the world's only atomic terrorist attack, not once but twice? Since Mr. Kerry is evidently challenged when it comes to facts, memories, and common sense, let me give him a hint. It was not the Russian Federation who used Georgia to launch a cowardly attack on Russia's southern flank in 2008, whose military advisors were cut up in the middle of the fighting, whose commando leaders were heard clearly saying in American accents, quote, "Get back inside," unquote, the troop carriers while they and their charges fled screaming. Who placed boots on the ground in Libya against the UNSC resolutions of 2011 and 1970 and 73? Who bombed the Libyan water supply? Who strafed Libyan civilian networks? Who destroyed the electricity grid to break their backs? Unquote. Who bombed a school of mentally retarded children? Who used the military hardware against the soft, non-military targets among countless war crimes in Libya? Who is the overlord of the Guantanamo Bay torture and concentration camp, where hundreds of detainees are held without charge, without access to due legal process? Answer the question, Mr. Kerry. I said, answer the goddamn question! That having been said, what moral right does the United States military-industrial complex and Pentagon and Wall Street have to go giving lectures to anyone about anything? None. John Kerry is a strange and rare bird, and stupid as far as I'm concerned, and cuts a particularly pathetic, quixotic figure, wholly and totally out of his depth, chasing demons that do not exist and denying the existence of those that do. And that is being kind. Let us take, for example, the classic affirmation that the Syrian terrorist forces do not have chemical weapons. They had, and they used them. And if John Kerry did not know this, he's either a fool or an idiot, incompetent or a puppet on a string, rendering him less equipped to be Secretary of State of the USA than the author of this article. The other option is that he is one barefaced, lying son of a bitch. And before he forgets or invents events regarding the current situation in the Ukraine, let us remind him and his nasty NATO sidekicks and also Jewish backers of a few facts. For a start, the Russian Federation has made it quite clear that this is not an invasion. It is a movement of troops within and around the Russian naval base at Sevastopol, wholly within the international law and within the terms of the agreement signed with the Ukraine. And outside this base, a humanitarian operation to protect ethnically German civilians from armed thugs who have spent the last few weeks stating they will murder Russians and Jews, shooting at the police and beating and torturing and murdering ethnic Russians elsewhere in the Ukraine. What was Russia supposed to do? Sit back and watch its citizens getting slaughtered? Once again, John Kerry will no doubt claim he is ignorant of these facts or will refrain from mentioning them. But here they are, the Russian Federation, having stated clearly that this is not an invasion, has its troops stationed in a non-combat operation to ensure the peace and to protect its citizens from the thugs you can see in these pictures. Let us ask Mr. Kerry who he thinks these thugs are. And once again, I repeat, Mr. Kerry, answer the question. Who are the thugs in these pictures? And what are they doing? Who are the victims? The police and ethnic Russians. So does John Kerry condone attacks against the police? How would the emergency services react in the United States if they were aware that Mr. Kerry supports these thugs who were firing live rounds at Ukrainian police force? Does John Kerry condone attacks, beatings, torture, and murder of civilians by armed groups of thugs? The Russian troops stationed around the Ukrainian military bases in the Crimea do not have magazines in their guns, and the Russian Foreign Ministry has stated that they are not there to stay, and indeed will leave just as soon as the political situation is normalized. The very fact that they were there brought an assurance from the so-called Ukrainian Prime Minister that all the minorities would be protected. Then why were the minorities not protected until now, and how to explain the photo on the left? It is an ethnic Russian terrified being set upon by a mob. Would John Kerry like to be set upon by a mob? Does he think that this is acceptable? Before John Kerry shakes the hands of the so-called new government, maybe we should warn John Kerry that under the Ukrainian Constitution, they are imposters, have no legal grounds whatsoever to claim the positions they are in. Indeed, they are usurpers who have seized power in a push, rather like Hitler tried to do. So in acknowledging these people in their positions, does John Kerry give the nod to a push and agree that governments can be brought down or instated by mobs on the streets? The proper legal proceedings for the removal and statement of a president under the Ukrainian Constitution, since John Kerry so obviously does not know this either. In fact, what does he know? Are for the prime minister to replace him. Well, anyhow, it goes on and on. But I can't disagree. I mean, I agree with the whole thing. John Kerry is, like most of these politicians and congressmen, senators in Washington, either inherited wealth or married into wealth, and then they get in there and they get more wealth by catering to the corporate structure, of which there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Only on issues that aren't that important. So, his wife was part of the ketchup company. The ketchup company, incidentally, that still puts an ingredient, I forget what it is, in their ketchup that is detrimental to your health. And that was found out clear back in about 1912. And first the government forced them to take it out of the ketchup, and then very shortly they bought their way back and put it back into ketchup. So here's a person that absolutely knows that they're putting chemicals into your ketchup that are bad for your health. I mean, it gives you a little bit of idea of the morality of these ruling class people. So John Clary could have just as easily have been a garbage collector that got picked up and put a new suit on and marry some rich broad, and suddenly he's into Congress, and now he's the Secretary of State. There's no more corrupt area of U.S. government than the State Department. And the State Department's bringing hundreds of thousands of non-whites into this country. Somalians and Ethiopians and you name it. Everything bad that's happening in this country that has to do with government comes from the U.S. State Department. I want you to remember that. And I'll bet you if you go into the State Department, you're going to find it full, disproportionately full, of Jews. Well, here's an oh my God story. The president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza, which means the race, the nation's largest mestizo civil rights and advocacy group, on Tuesday called President Obama the deporter-in-chief and urged him to use executive authority to stop unnecessary deportations. In an interview with Politico in advance of the NCLR Capitol Awards, Janet Murguia said, quote, "For the president, I think his legacy is at stake here. We consider him the deportation president or the deportation in chief." In her speech at the gala later that evening, Murguia elaborated, quote, "Any day now, this administration will reach the 2 million mark for deportations," unquote. Far short of what TT advocates, 15 million. Quote, "It is a staggering number that far outstrips that of any of his predecessors, and it leaves behind a wake of devastation for families across America. We respectfully..." Why didn't you think of that when you came here? "We respectively disagree with the president on his inability to stop unnecessary deportations." He does have the power to stop this. Obama has repeatedly insisted that his hands are tied and that he cannot unilaterally reduce the number of people being deported. An average of more than 1,000 people are deported each day. Well, that's a good sign. But there's probably 2,000 coming in, according to removal statistics from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Wow. There we go. There we go. Well, the FBI is saying that their strategy has changed significantly from the days when officials feared another coordinated international financed attack from an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. Today, counterterrorism experts believe groups like Al-Qaeda, battered by the war in Afghanistan and the efforts of global intelligence community, have shifted to a franchise model, using the internet to encourage sympathizers to carry out attacks in their name. The main domestic threat, as the FBI sees it, is Lone Wolf. Surprise, surprise. The Bureau's answer has been a strategy known variously as preemption, prevention, and disruption, identifying and neutralizing potential lone wolves before they move toward action. To that end, the famous but incompetent agents and informants target not just active jihadists, but tens of thousands of law-abiding people seeking to identify those disgruntled few who might participate in a plot given the means and the opportunity. And then in case after case, the government provides the plot, the means, and the opportunity. Oh, they wouldn't do that, would they? Here's how it works. Informants report to their handlers on people who have, say, made statements sympathizing with freedom fighters. They say terrorists. Those names are then cross-referenced with existing intelligence data, such as immigration and criminal records. The famous but incompetent agents may then assign an undercover operative to approach the target by posing as a radical. Well, I was hoping one would show up here and dump a satchel of money on me. And then I could tell him to get lost. Sometimes the operative will propose to a plot, provide explosives, even lead the target to a fake oath to Al-Qaeda. Once enough incriminating information has been gathered, there is an arrest and a press conference announcing another foiled plot. If this sounds vaguely familiar, it's because such sting operations are a fixture of the headlines. Remember, the Washington Metro bombing plot, the New York subway plot, the guys who planned to blow up the Sears Tower, the teenager seeking to bomb a Portland Christmas tree lighting. Each of those plots, and dozens more across the nation, was led by an FBI asset. No shit. I'm just shocked. Over the past year, some magazines and investigative reporting programs at the University of California, Berkeley, have examined prosecutions of 508 defendants in terrorism-related cases, as defined by the Department of Justice. Our investigation found nearly half the prosecutions involved the use of informants, many of them incentivized by money. Operatives can be paid as much as $100,000 per assignment. Well, look what they did to Matt Hale. Or the need to work off criminal or immigration violations. For more on the details of those 508 cases, see our charts page and searchable database. Sting operations resulted in prosecutions against 158 defendants. Of that total, 49 defendants participated in plots led by an agent provocateur, an FBI operative investigating terrorist action. With these exceptions, all of the high-profile domestic terror plots of the last decade were actually FBI stings. The exceptions are the Nabulon Zazi, who came close to bombing the New York City subway system in September 2009, and Hisham Mohammed Hadayek, an Egyptian who opened fire on the LL ticket counter at Los Angeles Airport and failed, Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad. In many sting cases, key encounters between the informant and the target were not recorded, making it hard for defendants' claims of entrapment to prove their case. Terrorism-related charges are so difficult to beat in court, even when the evidence is thin, that the defendants often don't risk a trial. The problem with the cases we're talking about is the defendants would not have done anything if not kicked in the ass by government agents, unquote, says Martin Stoller, a lawyer who represented a man caught in a 2004 sting involving the New York Herald Square subway station. Quote, they're creating crimes to solve crimes so that they can claim victory in the war on terror and spend more money. Oh, they wouldn't do that, the famous but incompetent, would they? Well, I guess there's a lot of guys sitting in those little cells around the country that wish they'd paid more attention to that article. Or, on the other hand, listen to Terrible Tommy. I said it all over and over and over and over and over again. Not that the conditions might arise where almost anybody could be scooped up. But if you put your head in a lion's mouth and expect the lion not to chomp, then you're foolish. Well, let's read a couple of paragraphs from the good book here. Might is right. The natural world is a world of war. The natural man is a warrior. The natural law is tooth and claw. All else is error. A condition of combat everywhere exists. We're born into a perpetual conflict. It's our inheritance, even as it was the heritage of previous generations. This condition of combat may be disguised with the holy phrases of St. Francis or the soft, deceitful doctrines of Kropotkin or Tolstoy, but it cannot be eventually evaded by any human being or any tribe of human beings. It is there and it stays there, and each man, whether he will or not, has to reckon with it. It rules all things, it governs all things, it reigns over all things, and it decides all who imagine policemanized populations, internationally regulated tranquility, and state-organized industrialism, so joyfully blessed and divine. Virtue is rewarded in this world, remember. Natural law makes no false judgments. Its decisions are true and just. Even when dreadful, the victor gets the gold and the land every time. He also gets the fairest maidens, the glory tributes. And why should it be otherwise? Why should the delights of life go to failures and cowards? Why should the spoils of battle belong to the unwarlike? That would be insanity, utterly unnatural and immoral. Oh, how about a little more of that? In this arid wilderness of steel and stone, I raise up my voice that you may hear. To the east and to the west I beckon. To the north and to the south I show a sign, proclaiming death to the weakling, wealth to the strong. Open your eyes that you may hear, O men of mild-wed minds, and listen to me, ye laborious millions. For I stand forth to challenge the wisdom of the world, to interrogate the laws of man and of God. I request reasons for your golden rule, and ask why and wherefore of your Ten Commandments. Before none of your printed idols do I bend and acquiesce. And he who says, Thou shalt to me, is my mortal foe. I demand proof over all things, and accept with reservation even that which is true. I dip my forefinger into the watery blood of your impotent mad redeemer, your divine democrat, your Hebrew madman, and write over his thorn-torn brow, quote, the true prince of evil and king of the slaves, unquote. No hoary falsehood shall be a trust to me, truth to me. No cult or dogma shall encamp my pen. I break away from all conventions, alone, untrammeled. I raise up in stern invasion of the standard of the strong. I gaze into the glassy eye of your fearsome Jehovah and pluck him by the beard. I uplift a broad axe and split open his worm-eaten skull. I blast out the ghastly contents of philosophic white sepulchres and laugh with sardonic wrath. Then reaching up and festering and varnished facades, your haughtiest moral dogmas I write thereon in letters of blazing scorn. Lo, behold, all is fraud. I deny all things, I question all things. And yet, gather round me, O ye death-defiant, and earth itself shall be thine to have and to hold. What is your civilization and progress if its only outcome is hysteria and downgoing? What is government and law if their ripened harvests are men without sap? What are religions and literature if their grandest productions are hordes of faithful slaves? What is evolution and culture if their noxious blossoms are sterilized women? What is education and enlightenment if their Dead Sea fruit is a catiphrase with rottenness in its bones? And that's the end of our reading from the Good Book. And that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow is Freya's Day, Ladies' Day, She-Wolf Day in the Bunker. Yeah, 14-5. And don't forget, Christ's insanity is a waste of time. There are no rights. There's only privileges granted by the ruthless rich. And there is no equality. Once you get those three things into your brain, you can't go too far wrong. And remember, for an informant to get next to you, first he has to pretend to be your friend. And since most so-called friends are simply acquaintances anyhow, what's your need for very many of them? Like I told people years ago, some friends of mine, I said, ask them, do you know what a friend is? And they said, what? I said, simply a friend who is someone who will take a bullet for you. So how many friends do you really have?